Let's take our Bibles tonight together and turn to Exodus chapter 26. Exodus chapter 26. Continuing our series through the book of Exodus. Last time we looked at the lampstand in chapter 25, the last part. We also looked at the table of showbread and the Ark of the Testimony as we back up through chapter 25. But I give the same introduction to my series to emphasize the theme of the book of Exodus. Remember that more than a third of this book pertains to the construction of the tabernacle. And the theme of the book of Exodus, could somebody please help me with that? What is the? You may not say it exactly, but what's the idea as we've seen the theme? Anybody? Here it is, that they might know me. God repeatedly says that they might know me. He said that about Moses. He said that about the children of Israel. He said that about Pharaoh. He said that about the Egyptians. I am doing this so that they might know me. I want them to know me. So we get to chapter 25, and we have two words that describe this dwelling place that God would have them build. You look in verse 8 of chapter 25, and it says, and let them make me. Make me what? A sanctuary. There's the first word. A sanctuary, a place that is set apart, a holy place. And we learn from that that the only environment that welcomes God is a sanctuary. The only place that welcomes God, the only person in whom he can dwell is somebody who is holy. And we cannot be holy and righteous by ourselves. I have the righteousness of Christ imputed to me. But he also asks us in Romans chapter 12 to present our bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. Now, that's the first word that describes this dwelling place. It's the word sanctuary in verse 8. Then in verse 9, according to all that I show thee after the pattern of the, and here's the second word, it's the tabernacle, an abode, a dwelling. So God's presence could indwell this place where he would meet with men. So during the time, the remaining time that Moses is on the mount, God instructs him concerning the tabernacle. Now, what's going to be in this place of dwelling for God? What's going to be in his house? As we look at this, we see the furniture of God's dwelling. And the order of construction takes place this way. Chapter 25, you start with the Holy of Holies, and you have the Ark of the Covenant. Then from the Holy of Holies, we move into the holy place where we have the table of showbread, and then we have the lampstand. We have this illustration given, and I'll just show it to you again so that we have this as a reminder. The tabernacle complex with its courtyard, the tabernacle itself, we start in the Holy of Holies, we go east into the holy place, where here we have the altar of incense, which has not even been mentioned yet. We have the table of showbread on the north. We have the lampstand on the south. Tonight we're going to look at the covering just of this complex right here. Not the entire complex. We're going to see just the tabernacle itself as we look at this tonight. So the curtains and covering for the tabernacle are for it, not for the court. The tabernacle, we remember, had to be built according to the precise dimensions that God gave. Precise materials had to be used, precise directions that even the tabernacle faced. It had to face a certain direction so that the table of showbread would be a certain direction, so that the lampstand would be a certain direction. We saw that last time. God is a God of order. God is a God of precision. God is a perfectionist. And he demands perfection. And we can't meet it. Only Christ meets that demand. And we meet God's demands through Christ. But that does not mean that we don't therefore try to live a life that meets his perfection and his demands. We'll never make it. But we should be progressively becoming sanctified, more and more holy. Now you would think that the next and the third object mentioned would not be the curtains, but that it would be the last piece in the holy place. And I mentioned it just a few minutes ago. In the holy place, let's go back east. It's over here facing east. Starting here, you've got the Holy of Holies. And in the Holy of Holies is the Ark of the Covenant. If you were able to, you would come through the veil and come into the holy place. In the holy place, we've looked at two pieces of furniture. On the north side is what? Table of showbread. On the south side is the lampstand, but right close to the veil is the one piece we haven't discussed yet, and that is not next addressed, as you would think so. It's the altar of incense. And men have questioned why, in this order, does he talk about the ark, go to the table, go to the candlestick, and then he talks about the covering or the curtains, and does not mention the altar of incense. That's not until chapter 30, and here we are in chapter 26. So the liberals like to teach that chapter 30 is a late edition with a different author. And you see, Moses didn't write that, otherwise he would have mentioned the altar of incense there. But God has a reason for the order in which everything is presented. And we won't see that tonight, but we will see that. So now you've got the furniture in the ark. What's going to cover it? Is it just supposed to be exposed? Or will it be covered? Now, this is the boring message I have for you tonight. I mentioned this morning. How exciting can it get to talk about the curtains? Well, you be the judge of that. Exodus chapter 26, we're going to read verses 1 through 14. You just tell me how exciting this is. Moreover, thou shalt make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen and blue and purple and scarlet. With cherubims of cunning work shalt thou make them. The length of one curtain shall be 8 and 20 cubits, and the breadth of one curtain 4 cubits, and every one of the curtains shall have one measure. The 5 curtains shall be coupled together one to another, and other 5 curtains shall be coupled one to another. And thou shalt make loops of blue upon the edge of the one curtain from the selvage in the coupling, and likewise shalt thou make in the uttermost edge of another curtain in the coupling of the second. 50 loops shalt thou make in the one curtain, and 50 loops shalt thou make in the edge of the curtain that is in the coupling of the second, that the loops may take hold one of another. And thou shalt make 50 tashes of gold and couple the curtains together with the tashes, and it shall be one tabernacle. And thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair to be a covering upon the tabernacle. 11 curtains shalt thou make. The length of one curtain shall be 30 cubits, and the breadth of one curtain 4 cubits, and the 11 curtains shall all be of one measure. And thou shalt couple 5 curtains by themselves, and 6 curtains by themselves, and shalt double the 6th curtain in the forefront of the tabernacle. And thou shalt make 50 loops on the edge of the one curtain that is outmost in the coupling, and 50 loops in the edge of the curtain which coupleth the second. And thou shalt make 50 tashes of brass, and put the tashes into the loops, and couple the tent together that it may be one. And the remnant that remaineth of the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that remaineth, shall hang over the back side of the tabernacle, and a cubit on the one side, and a cubit on the other side of that which remaineth in the length of the curtains of the tent. It shall hang over the sides of the tabernacle on this side and on that side to cover it. And thou shalt make a covering for the tent of ram's skins dyed red, and a covering above of badger's skins. Let's look at this tonight. The curtains of linen is what we see, first of all, in verses 1 through 6. There's actually 4 sets of tabernacle coverings that we read about tonight. You're going to have the linen curtain, then the goat's hair curtain, then the ram's skins dyed red, and covering all of those are the badger skins. There are 4 sets of tabernacle covering. Innermost are these curtains of linen. So when you would walk into the holy place, or even into the Holy of Holies, draped over it would be these linen curtains that we're going to see in verses 1 through 6. They are the most beautiful, the most exquisite of all. That's what the priests would see. Let's look first of all at the number. In verse 1, it says, with how many curtains? 10 curtains. You get to verse 3, and it says, there will be 5 coupled together and another 5 coupled together. So understand that you've got 2 sets of 5 totaling 10 curtains. The material they'd be made out of: linen, fine twined linen, or finely twisted linen. Go back to chapter 25 and look at verse 4 to see where this would come from. These are the offerings that are presented in chapter 25, where God says in verse 2, speak unto the children of Israel that they bring me an offering of every man that giveth it willingly with his heart. Ye shall take my offering. And you get to verse 4, and they are to bring blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen. That is for this first covering that we're talking about. Go to chapter 35 and look at verse 25. There you're going to see who puts this linen together, who makes this linen. 35:25, and all the women that were wise-hearted did spin with their hands and brought that which they had spun, both of blue and of purple and of scarlet and of fine linen. No doubt they learned how to do this in Egypt. Everybody's heard of Egyptian cotton. That the Egyptians know how to do things when it comes to linen. Alan Cole, in his commentary, said Egypt excelled in the production of linen, especially twined linen, where every thread was twisted from many strands. The Hebrew slaves must have learned many Egyptian arts and crafts, such as metalwork, spinning, weaving, and embroidery during their stay in Egypt. Linen was the dress of the noble and the priest in Egypt, chosen both for the coolness and cleanliness. Isn't it interesting how God would use their time in Egypt, what they had learned, and even what you may learn in the secular world, to do something for him? We look at the design next. The design in verse 1 again. And it says that cherubim were to be woven into the fabric. Now, how would they know what the cherubim look like? And yet, they're to be woven into the fabric. It implies the interest these real angelic beings must have had with what takes place within the tabernacle. Because we've read of the cherubim before. By the way, cherub is the singular, cherubim is the plural. The King James even adds an S to that and says cherubims, but that's double it. It's cherubim, which is the plural. These cherubim must have been interested in what takes place in this tabernacle. I find it interesting. Go with me to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. Were the prophets who prophesied of the sufferings of Christ, were they interested in knowing what they prophesied in the Old Testament? Look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 11. It says in verse 10, of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. Unto whom it was revealed that not unto themselves, but unto us they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preached the gospel unto you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven. So the prophets were very interested, and they searched diligently, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ. Remember when Jesus talked with the two on the road to Emmaus? And he said, have you never read the prophets? How they prophesied of my suffering? It's the prophets who were searching diligently into that. But now that's the prophets. Do you think the angels had ever been interested? I didn't finish verse 12. Which things the angels desire to look into. Do you think the angels are interested in God's plan of salvation? They desired to look into it. And so here in this tabernacle complex, woven into the very fabric that would cover the holy place and the holy of holies, are woven these cherubim. And it's almost as if it's an indication of their interest, their supreme interest in what's taking place. In fact, upon the Ark of the Covenant itself, you have the mercy seat. And the beaten work that's on the Ark of the Covenant is two beings. And these beings are the cherubim. Do you not think that they are supremely interested in what's going to be taking place there? And then it says, not only are we talking about the cherubim, but then it says of cunning work. Now the word cunning, when you think of the word cunning, I think of something that's kind of sneaky. Now he's cunning. Of cunning work shalt thou make them. Now I spent quite a bit of time on this little section, the cunning work, because it intrigued me. What is he talking about? You look back into chapter 25 to the two cherubim. This is found in verse 18 of chapter 25. The two cherubim atop the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant were of what kind of work? Of beaten work. The cherubim in the curtains were of cunning work. Now, obviously, you're not going to beat the curtains, but you've got this cunning work in the curtains. And the basic idea of the word is the employment of the mind in thinking activity, the creating of new ideas according to the theological word book of the Old Testament. So I never like to take for granted what the theological word book or any other book says. I like to search it out myself. So I looked up the Hebrew word for cunning, and I looked at every occurrence in the Old Testament and read every occurrence 121 times. I didn't go through my Bible. I've got this Hebrew lexicon that shows me every one of those words, so I could just go right down it and read the context of every one of those times when that word is used. In the King James, it's translated to think, devise, imagine, invent. That's that word cunning used elsewhere throughout the Old Testament. In fact, there's an interesting place where it's found in the book of Genesis, chapter 50 and verse 20. I've got it up on the screen for you. This is Joseph coming to the end of his life when his brothers thought that he was going to now kill them because dad has passed away, Jacob is gone. Now what's Joseph going to do? And here's what Joseph says. But as for you, ye thought, it's that word cunning. You thought evil against me, but God meant, there's that same word again. God meant it unto good to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive. Listen, while the brothers were cunningly planning or devising harm, God was doing the same for good. I love that. To see how that God overruled the devisings and the inventions of men. So he too devised and invented right back at them and took what they meant for harm and used it for good. I am glad that God can take what we do, sometimes in our ignorance, sometimes what we do intentionally, and he can use it for good. In fact, I think it's Psalm 76. I shouldn't have even started quoting this because I can't remember it. Where he takes the wrath of man and uses the wrath of man to praise him. It's used of Esther and Haman. Who was devising and cunning and planning in the book of Esther? Haman was. Same word. It's often a word used in association with somebody who is wise. In the building of his temple, Solomon talks about the man Hiram as being, and his men as being cunning men. And then in 2 Chronicles 2:4, let's go there because we can't see it in context just with what I have up on the screen. 2 Chronicles 2:14, you're saying, why are you spending so much time on this word? Because I find it fascinating and I'm the one preaching and you're sitting there listening. So 2 Chronicles 2:14, he says in verse 13, Solomon says, and now I have sent a cunning man endued with understanding of Hiram my father's, the son of a woman of the daughters of Dan, and his father was a man of Tyre, skillful to work in gold and in silver and brass and iron, stone, timber, purple, blue, fine linen and crimson, also to grave any manner of graving and to find out. And to find out. That's the word cunning right there. To find out every device which shall be put to him with thy cunning men. There the word cunning means wise. And with the wise men of my Lord David, thy father. I want your men to find out. The whole purpose, the reason I'm going through this is because when these curtains were to be made, they were to think about it. They were to find out. They were to study. They were to invent. Now you're saying, wow, this sounds like idolatry. Not when God commands it. And they're not to worship these curtains or these beings on the curtains. In 2 Chronicles 26:15, Uzziah, the king, it talks about him, and he talks about the engines that his men, that were invented by cunning men, weapons of warfare. And that whole phrase has to do with this idea of cunning. It's used again in Exodus 31:4. Go back to Exodus, look at 31:4. And God is talking about a man by the name of Bezalel. The God has called and says in verse 3, I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship to devise cunning works. To work in gold and in silver and in brass. Bezalel was no dummy. Bezalel was a thinking man. Bezalel was a man that God used to come up with something that was just absolutely beautiful. Go to chapter 35 and verse 32. Again, speaking of Bezalel. It says in verse 31, and he hath filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship and to devise curious works, to work in gold and silver and brass. And it goes on to say, the cutting of stones to set them, the carving of wood to make any manner of cunning work. And then it goes down, verse 35, he hath filled with wisdom of heart to work all manner of work of the engraver and of the cunning workman and of the embroiderer in blue, in purple, scarlet, and in fine linen. That's this curtain. And of the weaver, even of them that do any work, and of those that devise cunning work. This just fascinates me. That God knew what he was doing and had men come up with something that would glorify him. In the end, that just tells me something, that when we worship God, we don't do it with a blank mind. We do it with a thinking mind. And we're not devising new things that are outside of Scripture, but we are thinking about what God says and using our minds. God intended for these people to use their minds. He intended for them to be creative. You know, it's amazing how people can be creative to do wickedness. Isn't Obama creative? He really is. Because he can be really creative with wickedness. Satan is creative. But then when I'm getting ready to do something for God, your mind goes blank. Well, I don't know what to do, Pastor. What can I do? Well, did you see the trash out there in the parking lot? Did you see what needs to be done around here? It's like all of a sudden we have no creativity when it comes to the things of God. Boy, you want to find somebody who wants to somehow find a way to skip church? Man, they can come up with reasons. They've got to think. They're so creative, and you go, wow, oh, I'm so sorry you've got a miss. You know, I know you're, you know, and then they come up with this thing that you're going, wow.
We can devise ways to bring up in conversation what benefits us. But we cannot bring up in our conversation a way to witness to somebody. We can't become creative. Isn't that interesting? We can devise ingenious plans to get off of work to go attend a game or a sports tournament, but we can't devise ways to say, you know what? I need to make it to church somehow. Don't you find this interesting? How that we can come up with all kinds of creativity when it comes to doing what we want to do, but our minds go blank when it comes to doing anything for God. That's not these people. God expects the Israelites to employ the same creative juices that they used to employ, that they used to decorate their homes, to adorn his sanctuary. The prophet Haggai had to really get on the people's case in his book. He said, oh, so is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses while the temple lies here in waste? So you can spend all your time on your house, but you can't find any time to build the Lord's house? And he says, now I want you to consider your ways. Why is it that your money bags can never hold any money? Why is it that everything that you're doing is falling apart? I'll tell you why. Because God's temple lies in waste, and all you're spending your time on is for what you do for yourself. You do nothing for God. Read it sometime. Haggai chapter 1. Again, I say, I find it interesting that we can be so creative to do those things that benefit us. But when it comes to the work of the Lord, I don't know. I don't know what to do. And here's the kicker, if I might use that term. Who's ever going to see these blue, purple, scarlet cherubim on this curtain? Who is ever going to see it? You know who's the only people who are going to see it? Are the priests who walk in there. No one else is going to see it. Can only be seen from the inside, where most people would not even be allowed to go. And when you go in there, imagine the beauty. Because you're going to find out what the posts are made out of. Overlaid with gold. And every other post between them you would probably see woven into this linen fabric, these cherubim. Blue and scarlet and purple. And I would say that these people use their imagination to make it as beautiful as they possibly could. Well, we spent some time on that, the design. Then we get to the dimensions. Look at the dimensions in verse 2. The length of one curtain shall be 8 and 28 and 20 cubits. That's 28 cubits, which is 42 feet. And the breadth of one curtain, 4 cubits, that's 6 feet. So that's what you have up on the screen. You've got those dimensions. All 10 curtains, the same size. That's what it says, one measure. It says in the last part of verse 2. And then in verse 3, 5 curtains would all be stitched together, so it would make those 30 feet wide. And then with the hooks and loops mentioned that brought these two larger curtains together, you've got this one 30 feet wide, this one 30 feet wide. All these are stitched together. Then they would bring those two whole curtains together, and they would have loops and tashes, and they would attach those two curtains together. So that now you have this curtain 42 feet long, 60 feet wide. This is this linen curtain with blue, scarlet, and purple cherubim on it, brought together, and these tashes are made of gold. So the total, 42 feet by 60 feet wide. The tabernacle itself is 45 feet long, 15 feet wide, 15 feet high. Now, I've got this little illustration that somebody has. This is a little model that might help us understand. It doesn't mean that this is all perfect, but I think it'll give you a good idea of what it was like. Here's the tabernacle. This is the linen curtain that they have on it.
The tabernacle itself, from here to the back,
is 45 feet long.
It's 15 feet, 15 feet. So if you've got this curtain, which is 42 feet, that's why it doesn't touch the ground, because that totals 15 plus 15 plus 15 is 45. Everybody with me? So that's why it doesn't touch the ground. But it's 60 feet wide. And how long is the tabernacle?
45 feet.
So you've got the curtain, and it is 42. And from here to the back and then down the back,
it's 45 plus 15 is, and you got your 60 feet there. It doesn't go down to the ground in the back. The couplings. Verses 3 to 6, and this is where you read about the 50 loops, and then it specifies that these 50 loops have to be a certain color. Blue linen woven into the edge of each set of five curtains. To tie those loops of each set together, 50 tashes or hooks of gold, and this is to form one tabernacle. Look at the last part of verse 6. And it shall be one tabernacle. There we end the curtains of linen upon which or into which are woven the cherubim. Then we get into the next section. And you have the curtains of hair. That's verses 7 to 13. This is another, this is actually a covering. You look at chapter verse 7, it says, and thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair to be a covering upon the tabernacle. So this is going to actually cover the linen curtain that you just saw in that model we saw just a minute ago. So this is the second of the four sets, and this will cover the linen. What's it made out of? Goat's hair. So I got to think, oh, whoever makes anything out of goat's hair? Now, this is the beauty of the internet and YouTube. So I went on the internet. And they have YouTube videos of men spinning goat's hair and making cloth. And it was fascinating to watch. I didn't think you could do that with goat's hair. Janet, she probably, yeah, she's one of those. Yeah, they, and it was just fascinating. And all different kinds of colors. And so here you've got this goat's hair. And you go back to chapter 25 and look at verse 4. Again, it's part of the offering mentioned. You go to chapter 35 and verse 26. Again, it's the women who are doing this. Let's just go there, 35, 26. We read 35, 25 a minute ago. Then you get into the very next verse, 35, 26. And all the women whose heart stirred them up in wisdom spun goat's hair. So I got to thinking, I wonder if anybody makes goat's hair tents today. And I came upon this Saudi Arabian website. Those are tents that they sell made of goat's hair in Saudi Arabia. Made, and this is what the website actually said itself. It's made from pure goat hair, single layer, in a traditional style to reflect the old Bedouin tents used in the Arabian Peninsula for many centuries. Modern. A development of the traditional old goat hair tent, it is stretched on a metallic structure. Today, these types of goat hair tents are widely used in modern homes and farms. Saudi and Gulf people enjoy having these tents so they can experience the way their ancestors used to live. I thought, well, that's kind of an ugly tent. So I did some searching. That's not too shabby, is it? There it says, for luxury and great space that's yours, that's your choice, a Bedouin goat hair tent in a size of 48 square meters with more space at the front with Bedouin rugs and so forth and so on. Now, this is not even the fabric that would be seen inside the tabernacle. Remember, that's the linen. This is covering the linen. So as we move on, you get to the number of these tents or of these curtains that are to be made. Look at verse 7, the last part of verse 7, how many curtains should they make? How many of the linen were they supposed to make? So you've got one extra one that is made here. It's in 5 and 6. Go to verse 9. Thou shalt make 5 curtains by themselves and 6 curtains by themselves. Before you had 5 and 5, now you've got 5 and 6. Let's continue. By the way, since there's one more curtain here than in the linen, this would be broader than the linen in order to cover the linen. The dimensions are given in verse 8 and again in verses 12 to 13. Verse 8, the length of one curtain shall be 30 cubits. How long was the linen curtain? 28. So how many more cubits is this? 2 more cubits. So how many feet? 3 feet. This one is 3 feet longer. Let me see if I got those dimensions up there. Okay, there's the linen. 10 curtains at 42 by 6. The total will be 42 long by 60 wide when they're joined together with the tashes and the loops. This one, the hair, is 11 curtains at 45 feet long by 6. The total will be 45 feet long by 66 wide. So the difference is the hair tent would be 3 feet longer and 6 feet wider. So this is going to have to cover the linen completely so that from the outside, the linen would not be exposed whatsoever. Again, I stress the fact that the linen is seen only from the inside. It's not seen from the outside. This is the remnant. Now we've got in this model, you saw the linen curtain. Now you've got the goat's hair that covers it. That's the white one that they haven't done full way simply for the sake of you being able to see where it is. And then we're going to see these two in just a moment, maybe. Then you've got the couplings. Unlike the loops for the linen curtains that were made from blue, no color is specified here. Wonder why? Nobody sees them. The tashes or the hooks are not made of gold. They're made of brass or bronze, not gold. Then you get to the curtains of skins. And there's two of them here. That makes the 4 sets. You've got the linen, the goat's hair, the ram skins, and then what is called here badger skins. Let's look at the ram's skins. Verse 14. Thou shalt make a covering for the tent of ram's skins dyed red. Again, that's part of the offering mentioned in chapter 25 and verse 5. And then it talks about the badger's skins. That's part of the offering mentioned in 25:5. Badgers. Does anybody remember what the badgers was? What kind of skin? It's the manatee or the dugong. I think you were saying that's more of the name I've seen is dugong. It's a sea creature. I'm going to take you back to the notes that we had months ago talking about this. The Hebrew word is tahash and most likely refers to the skin of a marine animal like the dugong. That's from the Theological Word Book. One of the commentators said, a marine animal resembling the seal, more particularly the dugong or sea cow. And here's the pictures that we had. There's the dugong. There in relation into the size of a man. And so I went on the website, this is some time ago, and studied this a little bit. Approximately 7,000 dugongs are believed to live in the Arabian Gulf and the Red Sea. The seagrass diet has unfortunately restricted dugongs to the very shallow waters most intensively used by humans. This is what I find fascinating. They're in shallow water, which means, are they kind of easy to get to? Yeah. And as seagrass has very little nutritional value, dugongs must consume large amounts of it, as much as 30 kilograms in one day. Their grazing habits have earned them the nickname the camels of the sea. Until the 1980s, dugongs were actively hunted because they were considered a desirable source of cheap red meat. Long ago, they were a major source of protein for ancient Bedouin. They were basically having barbecued dugongs, spare ribs and shoulders of dugong meat, he said. It's a protective species nowadays. But back then, the Bedouin would make sandals from the hides and the tusks. And I've highlighted that for a reason, because you'll find this in the book of Ezekiel. God says, I clothe thee. Who's he talking about? The children of Israel in the wilderness. I clothe thee with broidered work and shod thee with dugong skins, the very thing that even today they acknowledge that way back then they were using their skins for sandals, for footwear. dugong skins would be highly water repellent. And so as you look at this model, you've got the ram skins dyed red, and then you've got what some have thought as badger skins, more likely dugong or manatee, that covers the entire tabernacle complex. Now, it's interesting because no dimensions are given for either the ram skins or the badger skins. But it does say, verse 14, and a covering above. So obviously, this is to cover the entire tabernacle complex. So these are the third and fourth sets of the four, covering the goat's hair and the linen sets. From the outside, the tabernacle would not be a thing of beauty. At least, not as much as the inside. And I close with this. The tabernacle, we know from the book of Hebrews, has a lot of typology. And this is what we know about the Lord Jesus Christ. When you look at him, he hath no form or comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men. Christ, it says in John 1:14, dwelt, the word came and dwelt among us. And that word literally means he came and tabernacled among us. And he was not seen by men as attractive. It may not even have to do with his physical features. It may just have to be with what he said and what he taught and what he came to do. But the only ones who saw the real beauty of the tabernacle itself that we've been looking at tonight were those who fellowshipped inside by means of blood atonement. And folks, we who are saved by the blood of Christ, who are now the royal priesthood, are the only ones who know Jesus Christ in his true beauty. And I believe that typology is scriptural. He hath no form of comeliness. And when we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. And they despised him and they rejected him. But every believer who truly comes to him sees him in his immense beauty. Because we're folks inside the Holy of Holies.